From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I could have lived without that line. The episode would have lived without that line. But I knew that if I lost that, the next silly battle would be easier to lose.
Television icon Norman Lear wrote sitcoms that tackled real issues like rape, abortion, and race relations. When the network wanted him to drop a controversial line, he just said no. The 92-year-old Lear talks about a few lifetimes worth of adventures in film and TV, and his new memoir, Even This I Get to Experience. But first on the News Banter, everyone in Hollywood wants some FaceTime with the richest man in China. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Kim.
So, Michael, the last week of October, quite recently, Jack Ma, the founder of Alibaba, which is the Amazon of China, and he is said to be the richest man in China, and that means really rich.
I assume that that's a high bar.
It's a very high bar. He came out to L.A. and appeared at a conference that the Wall Street Journal put on and then had some meetings with studio executives. And his team was also here in town. They are going to open up an office here. And Hollywood is starting to, like, drool in a visible way.
Well, they see dollar signs.
Yes.
And Kim, you actually wrote a really interesting piece in The Hollywood Reporter where you even dangled some interesting tidbits, such as the idea that down the road, you know, he may be potentially looking at a studio to purchase.
Yeah, well, what we've seen here is that Hollywood, especially on the film side, their executives have made this trek to China again and again, banging their heads against the Great Wall because there was so much money to be had, both in terms of Chinese box office and Chinese investment in films. And so many people have gone and very few have come away with money. But in this past few months, we saw Jeff Robinoff, the former film chief at Warner Brothers, get money out of Fosun International. We saw a new company, which doesn't have a name yet, run by a producer, Bob Simons, get some money from a company called Honey. And we are seeing Jack Ma from Alibaba strolling around in Hollywood. And it seems like it's getting more real, this potential that China will be a thing for Hollywood.
It's always fascinating to see these newcomers come to town, and they're the hot stuff for the moment. Another interesting tidbit you had in your story was the fact that everyone was trying to wine and dine Ma, including the folks at WME, Ari Emanuel and Patrick Weissel, who took him to a Lakers game, which, by the way, these days, I don't know if that's actually a good thing or not.
Well, it was the coup, actually, of this brief visit of Jack Ma, because there they were photographed sitting with this guy at this Laker game, very public thing.
Right.
And that is a way of saying, like, we could be the entree that this guy uses partly to get into Hollywood. Now, Jack Ma did not stay as long as people in Hollywood thought or meet with as many people as people were expecting. He met with Brad Grey at Paramount. He met with the team at Sony Pictures. But Kevin Sugihara at Warner Brothers had to settle for a phone call with him. And the guys at Fox and Universal didn't get any time with him at all. The team he left behind had a dinner, sort of interesting to me, Mike, at Toscana after he left, and it was really like an old Hollywood crowd. I mean, Mel Gibson came to this thing, and Ron Howard and Brian Grazer were invited, and Arnold Schwarzenegger was invited, but didn't go. So it seems like right now there's a little bit of a lag. There's a little bit like 1999 Hollywood was meeting these Chinese film representatives, but they're going to open an office here, and, you know, something's going to happen.
So the big question also is, what kind of productions are they looking at? What are they interested in now? I mean, you know, are they looking for more big event movies, the kind of things that translate well overseas, or are they interested in the Oscar race?
Well, I think they're probably interested in both from what I hear, but, you know, this was very preliminary meet and greet, and everybody wanted to get a feel. Nobody wanted to necessarily overplay their hand, and more will be revealed, but definitely the Chinese are going to be a lot more careful than a lot of other outsiders who have come in here and gotten fleeced, it appears. We'll have to see how Hollywood and China match off against each other. Meanwhile, Mike, another story we've been following, Kevin Reilly was ousted at Fox as the head of their broadcast network a few months back. We talked about that. He had said on this show and elsewhere that he was going to do away with pilot season, and then Fox did away with him. And he was out there for a while, and there was a big flirtation with Turner, which has TBS and TNT. And after it was on again and off again, off again, on again, it's on again. He's getting that job and running that those channels.
Yeah, what was interesting is that it seemed like for a while Kevin Reilly wasn't sure if he wanted this job. It's another one of these big network jobs, which he's already done several times over at Fox, at NBC, at FX. And on the flip side, Turner still wasn't quite sure what they wanted to do. They had to replace two executives, Michael Wright, who is now running over at DreamWorks with Mr. Spielberg, and also Steve Coonan, who is now actually basically running the Atlanta Hawks basketball team in Atlanta. So there was the big business job, but also the big programming job. And Turner couldn't quite decide, are we going to get someone who's more programming focused or someone who's more business focused? So in Kevin, they have someone who's a little bit of both.
Kevin, of course, you know, Fox did not do well in the last season, but they do have Gotham on the air this fall, which has been doing well for them. However, you know, it was a rough ride there in the end at Fox, and it's not necessarily going to be so easy programming these big cable channels, especially since I'm not sure that they know what they want. You know, they're talking about shows like Breaking Bad, well, you know, or Mad Men, but then, you know, is that really what people go to TNT or TBS to look at?
Right. They do have a little bit of FX and AMC envy at TNT and TBS right now, which is odd because some of the shows at TNT still do quite well. Rizzoli and Isles does almost 8 million viewers. That's a great number. That's a big hit. And TNT launched a couple new hits this summer under Michael Wright, including The Last Ship, a new show that's going to come back for a second season. So they're actually doing surprisingly okay, given the fact that they seem so not sure about the direction of the network. So when they've tried in the past to go a little edgier, a little different with shows like Men of a Certain Age, it hasn't done as well for the network. And then Michael Wright had to actually rein it back in. Well, now he's being criticized for not trying hard enough to do edgy stuff. Well, when he did, he was smacked down by Turner. So there have been mixed messages coming out of Turner for a while. So it's going to be really interesting to see just what Kevin's able to get away with over there.
So we'll see how Kevin Reilly does. And, you know, not the only turnover in an increasingly challenged cable business. It's not like it used to be where those things were just throwing off money.
Yeah, cable's looking a lot like broadcast now. Ratings are down. There's erosion. The ad sales are not as big as they used to be. So you've had big changes, not only at Turner, but recently at A&E, you have a new head of A&E and History, Paul Buccieri, who was a producer in his past life. He's running those two networks now. Discovery just brought in Rich Ross, who, as we know, was at Shine and before that was on the studio side for a while, but also helped launch Disney Channel back in the day. So he's now running Discovery. So you've got several major networks with new bosses all trying to figure out how to stem the losses.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider, executive editor of TV Guide magazine.
From Television City in Hollywood.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like us, we had it made.
Those were the days.
When Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton invaded America's living rooms as the bigoted Archie Bunker and his sainted wife, Edith, television was changed forever. All in the Family, which ran on CBS during the tumultuous 1970s, dealt with gritty issues, smashing the mold of fluffy sitcoms like Petticoat Junction and Green Acres. It was TV's number one show for five consecutive seasons. With his partner, Bud Yorkin, our guest today, Norman Lear, produced that show and many others, including Maud, One Day at a Time, What's Happening, and The Jeffersons. Now 92, Lear has written a memoir. Even this I get to experience. The book is a journey through Lear's life and a look at Hollywood history through the eyes of a legend who worked with legends, including Danny Thomas, Frank Sinatra, Mel Brooks, and Carl Reiner. When Lear joined us in the studio, we started out with a little reminiscing about the last time we met. You know, I was actually looking back at the piece I wrote about you for The Hollywood Reporter.
Yes.
When I asked Rob Reiner about you, he said you had balls the size of Montana. So I'm fact-checking.
Are we on the air?
Yeah, we're rolling.
Oh, and you're saying balls?
Saying balls on public radio air.
Well, for crying out loud. Well, he's right. And I mean, I walked in and I left them in the car.
Okay. So there's a lot of gambling in your story, right? And as you go through life, you're pretty gutsy about gambling.
Well, in business, I don't know. I guess you could call it gambling. I think of it more as conviction that is a gamble to others.
On a couple of occasions, and starting, I guess, with All in the Family, although maybe before, you wanted your cut, your version of the script, and you basically said, if you don't do it my way, I'm walking out of here. And you're saying it's a matter of conviction, not gambling.
Much more conviction. It turns out to be a gamble. Life is a gamble. You know, you get up every morning, you're gambling, you're going to be there the night to sleep and wake up the next morning.
Right.
Also, it sounds like, as you describe it, I won big wars.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the way it felt. The way it felt at the time was the network was being silly, ridiculous, or some network executive reporting to an executive above him who was reporting to somebody above him who was reporting to somebody in New York.
Right.
That's the hierarchy and the way it worked. Was making a silly decision in the first episode of All in the Family when Archie comes in from church having left the sermon because he was pissed off at the reverend and the sermon itself. The kids having the house alone, Mike and Gloria, they have decided to make love, and they rush downstairs when they hear the door close. Archie knows guesses what they were up to, and he says, 11:10 of a Sunday morning.
Right.
You're early.
So are you.
We're just going to go sit down over there.
Yeah, I'll bet. 11:10 of a Sunday morning.
They wanted that out. Why? Because it was specific. It pointed to the fact that they were going to make love.
Married couple.
Well, and that's what I said. Married couple. They were going to make love. 11:10, it had to come out. And I could have lived without that line. The episode would have lived without that line. But I knew that if I lost that, the next silly battle would be easier to lose, and the ones that followed from that. So I had to say there will be no show if you take that out.
But you have to mean it. If you say, I'm going to walk, you can't bluff.
Well, I did mean it. I did mean it.
When you did, you did All in the Family initially. I think you were doing it for ABC, and they kept balking.
Yes.
They were scared of it.
Yeah.
And they wanted you to redo it, and you left the script exactly the same.
The way the contract was written, they could cause me to do it again.
Right.
And that would allow them to hold it for a year, and they did that. And so I made it a second time for them, different young people, same Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton were there from the beginning. And it's my good fortune that it took three times to do it, because by then I ran into Sally Struthers. I hadn't known of her before. And Rob Reiner was now old enough, I thought, to play the role.
And you knew him since he was a little boy.
I did.
Yeah, because he was obviously the son of Carl Reiner, and you were friends.
Yeah, we were great friends.
So you had the cast, and you did it the same way every time. You didn't think, maybe I should make it a little different at all. I like it this way. This is the way it's going to be.
Well, there was no story at all, really. It was their anniversary. The kids were doing a brunch for them. My kid picked up a little gift for them. That was the entire story, so that I could write 360 degrees, what I call the 360 degrees of Archie Bunker. You'd hear the kind of things he might say at any time. I used to say to the network, we got to get wet together. We jump into the pool and we get wet. You're never wetter than wet.
Right.
And this script was designed to do that. So that's why I stuck with it.
Of all the people you've worked with, I think you talk about Carol O'Connor as the most difficult, challenging every script.
Mm-hmm.
What is the cause of that, do you think? Just fear, pure fear?
I think it was a couple of things. I think certainly fear. You know, we were reaching 50 million people a week.
That's a lot of people.
And he was it.
Yeah.
And he was playing the role he was playing. So he didn't like a lot of the things he was asked to do. Not because he was he wouldn't say those things, but because he disagreed about the story. One of the halcyon moments was we did a show where he was in an elevator with four other people. The elevator got stuck, and one of the people in the elevator was a woman who was due to have a baby in 2 weeks. She panicked, the baby is born, and he thought, cramped in an elevator. There was no way to do a show. The other relationships, everything was wrong. And then at the end, a baby was born. And I don't know. I can't explain it. He wouldn't do it. And I was too much in love with the notion of a camera on his face while the first sounds of a baby's life were heard.
Look at this!
Mr. Funker, he's perfect!
I hear. Ain't it supposed to cry or nothing? That sounds kosher.
You know, after a lot of Sturm und Drang, we did the show, and it was glorious. And the first one to understand that it was wonderful was Carol O'Connor.
And did he ever come back and say, you were right?
No, but when he passed, and I went to the home to see Nancy, she asked me to wait till everybody had left. And when we were alone, she unlocked the door to his study. And his desk was clean, but for one piece of paper. It was a letter I'd written him 4 years before, in which I told him how much I loved him and how grateful I was for him and how much I regretted we had these arguments all the time. And it was on that desk, she told me, every day, all those years. And we loved each other and still fought.
Yeah, it's just one of those relationships, I guess. And yeah. A talent like that is frequently not an easy person, right?
Not an easy person. And, I wrote a character. He inhabited it. There'd be no Archie Bunker just because I wrote him.
Right, of course. He was perfect. He was perfect for that. So looking back to when you grew up, you describe very engagingly in the book this childhood you had, and your dad ended up going to prison because he basically was a guy who failed in a lot of businesses and was kind of a con. Right? Mm-hmm. And this was a painful thing. And I think you've said in interviews that confronting this in this book was something you weren't that thrilled about having to do.
Well, I wasn't thrilled, but I knew I had to do it. I couldn't write the story without writing the truth, and that was my truth. It also framed or bended my character, whatever my character is. It was shaped in those years.
What do you think the impact was?
The impact was I wanted to at once run as far from the character as I could and hold on to him for dear life because I loved him.
You know, I wonder a little bit going forward as you got into show business. You weren't above a little bit of a con yourself. You kind of conned your way into Danny Thomas's notice.
Conned, you would say?
Well,
I called him and told him I had something he could do quickly for the Friars Frolic the next day.
But did you not get his number by proposing as a New York Times reporter?
I did. Yeah, no. I called his agent's office at the noon hour, hoping the agent would be at lunch, and he was. And I said, as quickly as I could, I said to his secretary, I'm Merle Robinson. That's the name I used.
Merle Robinson?
Because I love the name. And with the New York Times, I just spent a couple of days with Danny Thomas. I'm doing a story on him at the airport now. I'm flying to New York. I'm going to write the story on the – and I have a couple of questions. Oh, they're calling my plane. She gave me his number.
Okay.
He was fascinated with how I got his number.
So that worked for you.
So
you confessed.
So he thought, well, that's a funny guy. Maybe – so he said, get over here right away with the material. I said, couldn't get over for about 4 hours. He said – you said you were in Hollywood. I'm in Beverly Hills. But I hadn't written this thing yet.
So maybe you learned a little something that was useful at the knee of the old man, old father.
I learned you got to blow your own horn.
Coming up after a short break, Lear laments the current state of network television, but hasn't given up completely. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer and producer Norman Lear, the man behind TV shows like All in the Family, Maude, Good Times, and Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, among others. Lear's new memoir is called Even This I Get to Experience, and at 92, he's gotten to experience a lot. In addition to his decades of work in television, Lear is a longtime activist and advocate for progressive causes. He founded People for the American Way in 1981. 10 years earlier, when All in the Family started on CBS, Lear didn't see himself as someone sending a message. He was simply looking to entertain. But then his perspective started to shift.
We were accused of it in a harsh way. I mean, what I heard most of all was at the beginning, if you want to send a message, there's Western Union.
Right.
You don't use television to send a message. But a couple of years into it, I realized two things. One, we were serious people. I was a serious person. I collected serious people around me. We were writing about what we felt about the times, using the subjects that touched us as family members. And that reflected a point of view. I understood that. Then when I thought back to the shows that preceded us, the Beverly Hillbillies and Petticoat Junction and those shows, I realized they were presenting American families where the biggest problem might have been that the roast was ruined and the boss is coming to dinner. Or mother dented the car, how do we keep dad from finding out until she gets it fixed? Or,
yes, these little and trivial
that,
things.
If that didn't send wall-to-wall, floor-to-ceiling messages, I don't know what did. I mean, there were no problems in the American family. You know, there was no rape, there was no illness, there was no economic problems. Everybody was having a glorious time unless the roast was ruined.
Right.
So I thought, well, that's a heavy message. America has no problems at all. And I thought what we were doing is light message-wise compared to that.
We had Neil Baer. I know you know a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, I know Neil Baer.
Okay, you know a lot
of
people.
Neil Baer. Yeah.
So Neil Baer, who worked on ER for many years, was on the show recently,
right,
actually talking about his decision to come out as a gay person. And he said in those days he could do things about really serious, you know, he had one of the first HIV-positive people
right,
on the air. He doesn't think you can do that on primetime anymore. He thinks there's been a kind of a reaction away from it. And I don't know how much TV you watch now. I know you watch certain shows,
yeah,
but I don't know that you're watching network.
I'm not watching a great deal. No.
Are you?
And I understand from people who are showrunners that, like I think you were going to say about Neil, they don't think All in the Family could exist today, wouldn't get on the air today. And the subject matters we touched on wouldn't work today. They just wouldn't allow it. So, and I imagine that's what Neil was saying.
Yes, that's what he was. But it's a strange dual universe where you have this vibrant cable world with a show like Transparent, which you were a fan of, right?
On
Amazon. It's not even on television.
Right.
And at the same time, we have this kind of conservative broadcast network environment. Why would that be? I mean, the broadcast networks
because
are still the big
tent. Because we are a culture that looks itself in the mirror and doesn't see itself honestly. And we've become a nation of consumers, and it's all about selling. It's not about being real. It's not about reflecting truth. It's all about selling.
Your show, I mean, in the day, the shows on the networks reached more than 120 million people a week. That's an enormous, it's so different now. So when you look at the revolution in this business where you can't reach millions of people on the scale that you did, but you can do a show like Transparent on Amazon, is it better now or is it worse?
You know, I'd have settled all those years ago for a law or a rule that made television available 12 hours a day and not 24 hours and 24/7. And it's too much. I don't know what should be done about it, but, you know, walk into a restaurant and see a family of five, three people on their cell phones.
It's awful, yeah.
And some of them watching something, you know, kids in a family not talking, relating, but watching a show or playing a game or whatever. It would be all right if we talked about it and wondered out loud where we're heading, what we're doing. We might change attitudes. We might see things differently. But we're confined to bumper sticker conversations, you know, and people yelling at each other. That's right. How we get the news. No context.
Right. Very reductive kind of news sometimes. Excuse for news, I should say.
Yes.
So you've seen these revolutions. You went from radio to the birth of television, the VCR, all of that. I don't know. Do you come away? Do you say, okay, there's this internet and it's invaded our lives to the point where it's disrupting the dinner table. Do you feel discouraged by that, or do you think we learn how to handle this thing, this digital monster?
I'm concerned with real problems and where they could end up. Climate change, I think, is very real.
Yeah.
I worry about that. But I don't want to wake up any morning I'm without hope, so I won't.
You decline.
So I'm hopeful. I don't know how we get through, but we'll get through. And given how many planets there are, a billion among in universes of which there may be a billion, how do we know how many other peoples like us vanished over the centuries?
Right.
You know, how far they came and how quickly in nature's timeline they vanished.
And let me just, at the end of your book, you write, as I report on myself in these pages, what surprises and pleases me most is the consistency in my life. What does that mean?
It means I've always basically, you know, there was a hurricane when I was 11 years old and living with my grandparents, and I was at Woodmont, Connecticut on the beach for the summer, and everybody lost their clothespins. And I went into New Haven with two
pillows. I feel like I can see this coming, yeah.
With two pillowcases, and there was a clothespin factory, and I filled up the, and it sold clothespins, three for a dime or a nickel or whatever the hell it was. So, you know, that dogged personality or persistence or whatever, that's been consistent. Fairness. When I learned at age 9, listening to Father Coughlin, that people hated me or at least disliked me or didn't want me because I was Jewish, despite a First Amendment and a Bill of Rights and guarantees for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that's been a steady in my life. So when I realized that black people had it far worse than others, and other minorities and disabled and so forth. Just basic, you know, I can't say fairness without saying American. Basic American fairness. And where it doesn't exist, as it didn't, I thought, when the evangelicals began to proliferate on television, didn't seem fair at all to me. And those are the through lines in my life, a number of those, and that's what I mean. I'm proud of that consistency.
You're commonly referred to as an icon. How weird is that?
That's weird. That is truly weird.
Norman Lear is a writer, director, advocate, and a force behind TV shows like All in the Family, Sanford and Son, One Day at a Time, The Jeffersons, Good Times, and Maude. His memoir, Even This I Get to Experience, is available now. Thank you for coming in.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.